National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
One of the frequent complaints among parishioners is on the quality, content, and of course, the length of the homilies they hear every Sunday from their parish priests. A new week-long program at the Catholic University of America is teaching the, quote, lost art of delivering an effective sermon. This week on Register Radio, we're joined by Register Senior Editor Zelda Caldwell to talk about preaching boot camp. And then, for the last 11 years, Catholics have been flocking to a beach on Long Island for Mass. What is the beach Mass, and how does it connect to the Eucharistic revival? We're joined by Elisa Murphy, the Register's Managing Editor of Digital Assets. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. I'm joined, as always, in studio here in Washington, D.C. by Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Shannon, how are you?
Hello, Matthew. I'm well, thanks.
Well, if anyone who might have wandered into the Catholic University of America's Heart Cathedral on July 15th might have mistaken, as Zelda Caldwell writes, the 29 men standing in a circle on the stage for an improv acting troupe, not a group of visiting diocesan priests. This rather remarkable scene unfolded during the first day of a week-long boot camp called the Compelling Preaching Initiative. Its purpose is to help priests deliver more effective sermons. This is a very interesting new program, and certainly, I think, first, let me welcome Zelda Caldwell. How are you?
Hi, Matthew. Great to be here. Thank you.
Appreciate your coming back to Register Radio. So, let's just put it this way. A lot of people would consider that this isn't the golden age of homilies. I know Pope Francis had many critiques about how homilies should be delivered, and certainly their length. But this is a pretty interesting project, and I'm so glad that you were able to write about it. You have some beautiful stories in here about the priests, and I'm going to ask you to mimic some of the sounds that they're trained to do in a minute. But let's start with that basic question. Why was there the feeling that we needed to have this kind of a program?
Well, at the School of Theology at Catholic University, they started hearing from some of their recent graduates who said they didn't feel like they were that well prepared for the pulpit, for speaking to parishioners, for celebrating the Mass, for giving homilies. And so they thought about it, and they thought they could come up with this boot camp where priests could come from around the country and learn some techniques with the help of the school's drama department.
So bringing together priests who felt they needed work in their homilies, it's an interesting sort of variety of priests, though, isn't it? They seem to come from a very diverse set of backgrounds.
Yes. When I went to the theater and saw them in action, and I think the organizers were surprised that there were a few who are on the older side. They've been doing it, obviously, for decades, but they thought they had something to learn. And there were quite a few who English was not their first language.
Right.
So they all got an invitation from their bishops to if you think you could benefit from this class, sign up. It's free of charge, and give it a shot.
Yeah, Zelda, I love this story for so many reasons, but it's really the takeaway for me is that these priests were there for us, right? For our mm-hmm. benefit. There's a lot of things, I'm sure, that they could have been doing with their time, including just enjoying the summer months. But here they were, and so we're really, you know, the beneficiaries of that, number one. The number two was you introduced readers to Melissa Flame, who was kind of directing the activity that you witnessed. Tell us a little bit about her and some of the tips that she really focused on with these men.
Melissa Flame teaches drama and voice and speech at Catholic University. And she's also a voice coach for professional actors at Sirius Theaters in the D.C. area and in Baltimore, the Shakespeare Theater. And she has a way with the priests. She was a riot. She was hilarious. She got them to relax. She got them to stretch and touch their toes and massage their jaws and told them, had them make all these funny noises and play these games. She called them theater games, where one would say "bah," and turn to the other, and he would say "bah," and then if another one would say "zip," and they'd have to direct the zip across to another priest through eye contact. So it taught them how to project their voices, how to connect with their audience, all with a game. And they seem to be enjoying themselves. They were laughing. They were having a good time.
But there's a kind of a serious dimension to this, too. I mean, as we were just discussing, the fact that you have priests who are dedicating this time to improve their homilies. Now, it's a cliche that parishioners always grump and complain about homilies, but this is the importance of a homily in a mass. So these priests who do dedicate a lot of time every week in any parish, but for these priests then to want to really improve what they're doing in homiletics, what was your takeaway on that?
Well, I found it heartening. She said that the most common mistake that a priest makes is he can spend a lot of time on his homily, preparing it for it, praying about it, and he's thinking, "What I want? I want to teach something. I want to teach about, say, forgiveness." But the thing he doesn't tend to think about is what can he say that would cause the people in the church to do something about it. He's not thinking about it from their point of view. What could he say that might make them pick up the phone and call, you know, that brother he hadn't spoken to for 10 years? So get them thinking that way about it.
Yeah, it's effective speaking techniques with not just so people after Mass say, "Hey, I really loved your sermon, Father," but actually they're trying to get us to act right on what they're saying. So that's so interesting. I thought some of the things that she picked up on, one of it is that American speakers tend to trail off at the end of their sentences. Is that something that surprised you?
I think we all know the experience of hearing a lecture and almost falling asleep, having to wake yourself up. And I think that might be part of it, yes.
Was there a prescribed length for a good homily, or does it really vary where you are and circumstances?
Melissa Flame gave the priests a lot of credit that they could come up with the homily, good homily themselves. So she wasn't, she didn't tell them exactly how long it should be. Okay, 5 minutes, do you really think?
5 minutes? I know Pope Francis was thinking 5 to 10 minutes, is that right?
I think he said 10.
10,
right?
Yep. Yeah. Now, I know in places like Africa, I know I've been there, the Mass in Tanzania, for example, where the homilies could be 40, 45 minutes. And so it does vary significantly. I don't see many American Catholics willing to sit for 45 minutes for a homily.
Yeah.
But again, the content is always a question. But there was another aspect, too, in the story, if I'm remembering, where you talk about the fact that because of social media and other things, that people aren't used to listening.
That's right. Well, they're not used to listening, and they're not used to speaking either. I mean, that's the point that Melissa Flame made to me was that these priests, they text, they write, and it's not just priests, it's actors, it's lawyers, it's anybody who has to speak for a living does a lot of it, you know, typing. And so she says part of why she is doing this is why she does what she does, and she gets hired by a lot of people, including, you know, actors and lawyers, is to teach people the art of speaking. And her idea is that your voice can be the truest expression of you. And so the point of this is to help priests convey that, their authentic self. It's based on this book by Kristen Linklater, which is all the, you know, that is, it's no longer like the rain in Spain, it's mainly the plane. It's
right.
Like they concentrate on teaching people how to use your authentic voice, be natural.
Zelda, I know when you came back from this, you were utterly charmed by what you witnessed. We just have a few minutes, but there was another story that you had a similar reaction to, and this was about seminarians. So not even priests yet, but priests in training, and they've increasingly are going through what you called a digital detox. What's going on there, and what did you find out in that story?
Yes, there's a trend for the first year of seminary. It's called the propedeutic year. Seminarians they take away their smartphones. They're not allowed to use them for anything. They can use computers and things to stay in touch with their families. They're not cut off from the world. But they found their formators have found that that they cannot develop spiritually as human beings or spiritually without this sort of detox. It's harming their development. So before they begin any academic studies, they spend a year working on this. And one of the first things they do is teach them just how addictive smartphones are. They teach them about dopamine. And all the seminarians I spoke to were so grateful for that year. They read more. They made friends. They could pray more. They could do everything because they weren't looking for that quick hit of dopamine that we all get whenever we respond to a text, whenever we hear the little notification on our phones. So it really was a lesson for all of us.
Yeah, the term doom scrolling pops into my head of the wasted time that all of us do on iPhones. But for a seminarian, this must be truly beneficial.
Yes. All of them said it was the best year of their lives.
High praise. Yeah.
So from your standpoint, in talking with these seminarians, but then also talking with these priests, what does this tell us about where we are in terms of our seminaries, but also in terms of our presbyterate?
Well, I am very hopeful. I mean, those young men I spoke to, I mean, they were such great guys. I was so touched by how honest and open they were and how serious they took their vocations. And I saw it in the older men, too. I think there's a lot of positive things. There's a lot to be hopeful about.
Yeah. Well, Zelda, I know we can find your stories, especially the Digital Detox First-Year Seminarians Fast from Smartphones at ncregister.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to having you back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, you're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Next up, we talk with Register Digital Editor Elisa Murphy and hear about why beach masses on Long Island are drawing the faithful. Stay tuned here on EWTN.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio, along with Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register here in Washington, D.C. But right now, we're talking about Long Island, New York, where three parishes, a tri-parish community, has banded together, and they've been doing this now for a decade, actually more than a decade, of holding beach masses. And the whole program, called Beach Catholic, is intended to bring people during the summer months to the ocean, to the beach, for Mass. That raises a lot of questions in a lot of people's minds, and the perfect person to talk about that is Elisa Murphy, who is our digital assets editor here at the National Catholic Register. Elisa, so great to talk with you again.
Likewise. Glad to be here.
So the title of your great piece, and I absolutely love the pictures that we were able to include, A Surf, Sand, and Sacrament. Hundreds attend Long Island's Beach Catholic Summer Mass. What is this for people who may be mystified at hearing this?
You know, and some people frown upon the idea of Mass and the beach together. It conjures up images of flip-flops at church,
right.
A very faux pas to many. But what they're doing in Long Island is very unique, and it's actually been going on for over a decade. It started 11 years ago with an idea of Father Brian Barr, who's been there for a long time. He's been running this entire thing, and he just realized, you know, one of the parishes is literally 50 feet from the beach. Then there's two other ones. It's a very beach community. And he said, you know, why not? Have we ever done that? Have we ever had Mass at the beach? And he got the okay to do it. And fast forward 11 years later, a few weeks ago, I think it was 1,100. It's been climbing this past Sunday. They had 1,400 people there. And as you know, the beach is very casual, but Father Barr said, you know, reverence was key. It was crucial in this entire organization of this mass. And it really is reverent from, you know, I've seen the images as well as speaking to some of the parishioners. I'm still seeing maybe I should go there for a weekend and check this out myself. But even the altar and the cross have significance. The wood that was used was actually, they were made by a carpenter who's a parishioner there out of the wood left over from the destruction of Hurricane Sandy from the boardwalk. So even the wood that's there, the altar, it all has significance, especially to this community that was really, you know, hard hit by Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, you did a wonderful job in telling the story, Elisa, and the photos really put you there. I mean, they were beautiful. It made me very homesick for the Jersey Shore, I must say. It also reminded me of some of the outdoor masses, some of the papal masses that we've seen, you know, these massive crowds. And, you know, of course, when you get a crowd that big, it's difficult to, you know, maintain the idea of a church and a holy place. But, you know, somehow it does work. How does this tie in, do you think, with the National Eucharistic Revival?
You know, I really think it's so interesting to find out about this story after we've been witnessing the Eucharistic Revival as well as the pilgrimages, because it really is a public display and people witness this. So in speaking with Father Barr, he said most people that do attend the masses are locals. They live in the area, but he's heard distinctly from voices that now come that are only there for the summers. You know, one guy that literally was just riding his bike, a nice Sunday afternoon, evening, you know, ride along the ocean and saw the mass. And he was a fallen away Catholic. And he actually came back to the church through this mass. So it really is about evangelization. And it's very unique because you are catching people. You know, normally it's a 6 p.m. mass. So it's a lot of people maybe even heading to dinner. Of course, it's a very populated area, especially in the summertime. But tourists have really been moved by this themselves.
Yeah, let's go back to how did this whole thing get started? Someone had to come up with the idea of a beach mass.
Yeah, so Father Brian Barr, it's kind of his brainchild, his idea. He said, you know, have we ever done this? And they kind of started it, now 11 years in the making, and it's just grown. I think the first year was only a few hundred that came, but he's been really building it. And their operations guy, Jordan Bernhardy, he's been there for the past 8 years. He literally works with this parish because of the beach mass. He was so inspired by what was occurring in the community that he wanted to be part of it. And he is really trying to build the locale there, the Catholic locale, as well as bringing in tourists. But they have events throughout the year. They're known as the parish that doesn't sleep. So they put on events all the time, even for young adults. And also they're very active on social media. That's actually where I first saw these images, and they're really trying to evangelize, as Pope Leo has now inspired people to be the missionary church. Jordan said, you know, as Pope Leo said, this is the hour of love, and how best can we reach people than to be where they are? And I think even now with Jordan kind of at the helm there too, it's really growing to these vast numbers.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the National Eucharistic pilgrimages that we've seen. And, you know, suddenly the Blessed Sacrament is coming through neighborhoods and downtowns and things. And there's just this evangelism that goes on in the street. What is that? What is going on? And I imagine that's the case with these beach masses, which I think because of your story and maybe because of our radio show might see a little bump in attendance. You've been on a roll, Elisa. I've been telling you that. You've brought us some great and important stories in recent days. And one of them I wanted to touch on was we just saw pro golfer Scottie Scheffler win the British Open He's an amazing golfer, of course, and an amazing young man. But there's been this outpouring of interest in him because of his family life and his faith. Tell us a little bit about why he's in the news right now, besides his victory.
You know, I'm actually not the most avid golf person. I'm not a golfer myself. It's a bit of a high price point for me. But learning about Scottie Scheffler has been so fascinating. And he's only 29 years old. He's literally won four major titles now. He's going for a big one next year. But he stole the hearts of many with this beautiful moment where he's literally receiving the award for the U.S. Open. And who should be coming along from the 18th hole on the green is this bubbling, toddling one-year-old that's just trying to get to his dad. And he's literally going along the grass, trying to get up, and he keeps falling. He fell at least twice. An official actually kind of has to help him, but the dad is beckoning him here. Come here, come here. And he picks him up. And in that moment, it was such a witness to the whole world about the priorities of this young golfer, because he really is about faith and family and putting it first. And before this viral moment, he actually gave a press conference where he was really talking intimately about his career as a golfer and how important it is. Of course, you know, this is his job. He tries to do as best as he can, but how he would drop any of it in a second if ever it jeopardized any of his family.
I was going to say that one aspect, too, as a result of this is it's easy to criticize a lot of mass media and corporations and things in promoting sort of an agenda that's very contrary to certainly what the church believes and family life. But to its credit, Nike had, you were able to embed this, their post on X about priorities unchanged. They wrote another major secured, and it's a picture of him winning a major golf event, but then saying you've already won, and it's a picture of him with his son. So this is a very positive image, not just for family life, but also for fatherhood at a time when fathers are really under attack in so many different ways in culture.
That's so true. And also, you know, just given Nike's track history, right, they've had tremendous amounts of promotions that really, you know, are promoting transgenderism or a lot of the woke ideologies. So I'm glad they took this moment to capitalize on what Scottie Scheffler did, but I hope more people see what he does. I mean, he's a Christian man. He and his wife are actually high school sweethearts. So not only an image of fatherhood, but also of matrimony, of being a father and a mother, and the relationship they have is just very unique. So for the public to take this moment to really herald what he did is just a great opportunity.
Alisa, to me, it also showed how sort of hungry and desperate we are for some demonstrations of basic family values, for portrayals of family life that are very normal. And people, we're really hungry for that, so that when we see it, especially when it's coming from a celebrity like Scottie Scheffler, it gives us hope, I think.
Yeah, it really is. You know, when we think of celebrities, we think of the stardom and the flair and the fans around you. But in that limelight, Scottie Scheffler said, after any win, after anything that he does, the first person I look for is my wife. She's always the first person I want to celebrate with. And I think that that's just a moment for us all to reflect on this fast-moving digital world where we're always kind of looking for the next thing and looking for likes and popularity, to think of the person sitting next to you on the couch and the ones you know that are the closest to you, to hold them with the same reverence.
Yeah, one of the things that he said that was really striking was the fact that he recognized that if this sport were to begin really impacting his family, he would walk away from it. And that's a level of commitment to family life. As he says, this would be the last day that I play out here for a living. So that's a great role model, especially for young athletes today.
And it really shows that the culture is shifting. because so many people, you know, don't take that approach and they think their career is everything. You hear of these terrible stories of families breaking up because the career became the main focus. So for him to speak so succinctly, and it was so funny, he just kind of, you know, really went into these details where at one point he even asked the journalist, like, I hope I'm making sense here. But he was just being really brutally honest about what was most important to him. And then I thought it was funny. It was just later on that after he won, the PGA Tour was already saying, like, oh, well, we're looking for Scottie Scheffler to win next year. Mm-hmm. So the Grand Slam. So, I mean, it's kind of an ongoing, you know, that you can see the intricacies working inside him, that his faith and his family come foremost.
That's exactly so. Well, it's been a joy, actually, to have some very happy stories, to be able to end Register Radio this week on a happy story. So, Elisa, thank you so much, and we look forward to your next pieces.
Wonderful. Have a great day.
Well, that's it for Register Radio this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining us here on EWTN. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please, take care, and God bless.